This episode is brought to you by Boast.ai. Each year, the US and Canadian governments give out billions of dollars in R&D tax credits and innovation incentives to fund businesses like yours. But the application process is cumbersome, prone to frustrating audits, and receiving the money can take up to 16 months. Boast.ai gets you access to research and development tax credits and innovation funding opportunities without the headache and red tape. Join thousands of North American companies leveraging Boast.ai software to maximize cashback. Check out www.boast.ai.
I think with alignment, the most important thing is trust and mutual respect. Ultimately, we're in a people-driven business and relationships really matter. And so I think a really healthy partnership starts with the acknowledgement that we are on the same team and we are there to help you accomplish everything, like when we win together. And not every partnership in our industry always works out. And there's always like some drama here and there. And I think that always stems fundamentally from misalignment. Trust, communication, mutual respect, and alignment. Those are the core pillars for any incredibly successful partnership.
I need some traction. You need some traction.
Hey, what's up, innovators, entrepreneurs, visionaries, and disruptors? This is your Traction podcast host, Lloyd Lobo. We're a community of over 100,000 people, just like yourself, on a mission to help you get the methods, the money, and the madness to explode your business growth. Featuring stories and tactical advice straight from those who've done it before, like Shopify, Twilio, Asana, and many more.
I need some traction. You need some traction.
Hey, Traction fam. Super, super excited to sit down with Roy Luo, general partner at Iconic Growth. We're going to break down what it takes for startups to thrive in the 2025 venture capital landscape. AI is not only disrupting industries, it's disrupting startups, and it's also disrupting VC. Roy, I don't know, looks like a 22-year-old to me, but he's invested in companies like Figma, Canva, Ramp, Bill.com, Flowcast, and many iconic companies. So we're going to dive into the current state of fintech investing, how to raise in 2025, what does VC 3.0 look like, and how AI is reshaping the venture capital world, and then key trends that startups must prioritize in 2025 to break out. Roy, thanks for joining us, man.
Thanks so much. A pleasure to be here.
Before we dive into the fun stuff, I wanted to ask, do you have a skincare routine? Like, how do you look? Don't give me the Asian genetic theme here. Is there a personal routine? And maybe tongue in cheek, doesn't have to be skincare or anything, but maybe it's you work out or there's a specific focus on nutrition. There's something that you do that you're glowing.
You know, I try to eat clean, exercise, nothing too special. I hate to try and rely just on genes, but I'm told that it's a blessing to look young. So let's see how long it lasts.
The venture space is a very hard one, right? You're always out. You're always talking to entrepreneurs. It can be high stress. What sort of exercise and nutrition routine are you on that keeps you playing the long game?
It's funny. I think it's just like my dietary preferences. I eat a lot of seafood, veggies. Like I'm not big into carbs, actually. People think I'm weird. I'm like, yeah, not bread, stuff like that. I don't drink any soda, not a lot of sugar. The life of this role, I think we're traveling quite a bit too. So if anything, I've been told that my superpower is I can take these micro naps. And so if I'm on a plane or I'm on a car, I can capture these in. So I can still do red eyes at this age and be fresh for board meetings or other meetings or conferences and things like that.
Sleep is huge. A lot of people like focus on diet and then diet and nutrition and then exercising, and they go hard on exercise, but they ignore that sleep is so important, the recovery part of it. Awesome. I want to get into your backstory, man. You took a traditional path into venture and growth investing. What drew you to this space, and how did your time starting out in capital markets and real estate shape your perspective?
Oh, totally. No, it's funny, but I actually started my career originally thinking I would go into medicine. I worked in capital markets as a way to just get some work experience and earn a buck to be able to pay for medical school, actually. I was in New York at Goldman Sachs at the time. And I learned through different walks of life, people I met, that eventually I didn't think that medicine was necessarily a path that I would want to pursue long term for a career. And so my first job out of school was really a means to an end. And that end wasn't really the goal for me anymore. And so I explored real estate a bit because I was like on a self-discovery journey in terms of like where my passions really lied. And very quickly, I found myself like working hard, learning a lot. But when I would leave the office, like my brain would turn off on work and I would think about other things. And I learned through that process that my passions really were in discovering different worlds, industries, professional categories. And very quickly, the theme was that technology was showing up everywhere. And having a deep understanding of any business, any category, any end market allows you to really appreciate how technology is impacting those industries. And I would go to drinks, I would catch up with friends, and I found myself just thinking about tech no matter where I went. And that was the after office hours, like energy was being spent. So having realized that, I knew that in order to have a true, like long career and something that you're really interested in, you need to pursue your passion. And so through that, I actually moved into a role in technology investing, and I've been doing that ever since. And I love it. Yeah, I get to learn about all the things around me in the world and how tech is impacting it.
So you were at TCV after Goldman, and then after TCV, you've been at Iconic, right? These are both, for our audience that doesn't know, maybe summarize for us what kind of funds is Iconic, TCV, and what makes an interesting company and stage for your fund to invest in?
Totally. So TCB was a great place to get started for me. I think there are some really smart investors and smart people there. And I learned so much during my time there. And they're an older firm. They were started in 95. And I think they just had a lot of institutional knowledge that they were able to impart upon all the folks that have gone through that system. And through that, you learn a lot, not only about how to work with founders and what makes a good investment and how to invest in technology, but you also learn a lot about yourself. And, you know, what I quickly learned was, you know, what does the world really need when it comes to partners in terms of building new disruptive technology businesses? And I had met people at Iconic during my time at TCV and really discovered that I think there are a lot of smart people, great partners out there in this world. But the platform that Iconic has been able to build is very special, very unique. And to be able to have the opportunity to join that team and then create this and extend it to the technology landscape is a very special and privileged position to be in that I'm very grateful for every day. Our community, we have access and ecosystem of really special people across all walks of life. And when you think about what we can do for our portfolio companies, I humbly say I'm a conduit as a partner to be able to bring the power of our community to other founders and leaders of businesses. And when you can do that with the top leaders of Fortune 500 businesses or places like Microsoft or retail businesses like Nike or Adidas, that's pretty cool and it's pretty unique. And to be able to be a part of that, even a small part of that, I think is a huge privilege. And so that was a big driver for me to be able to join this community, join this platform. I love the people that I work with, and we're hopefully continuing to do what we do and invest in some of the best businesses out there.
And the kind of funds that TCV and even Iconic are, you guys are not like the typical Silicon Valley venture early stage investors. You're not doing pre-seed. You're coming at what? Like a Series A or like more maybe Series B growth capital, right?
Yeah, the word growth is a little odd, I would say. And so I know we have the name as Iconic Growth, but we'll do anything as early as Series A, Series B, a lot of Series A's and B's. Our funds are quite large and we can go all the way up to pre-IPO and IPO rounds as well. And we actually have a great track record of being supportive public market shareholders as well. And we bought in the open market in businesses to support them in the public as well. The scope, I would say, is unusual in terms of how wide we go in terms of stage and maturity of business. And so the way we maintain focus is we focus at that top thin layer of just best of breed businesses, best leaders, best products in strategic categories. You're right, we don't necessarily do seed investments. We're definitely looking for best founders with product market fit, but that can still extend into the earliest of days in businesses.
Your thesis specifically has been fintech. Is that because of your Goldman Sachs and real estate investing background, or how did that come about?
Sort of. When I was still at Goldman, this is going to sound silly, but I had this idea of like effectively what was Venmo before Venmo had really started taking traction. And obviously it's this huge, big thing. And I think everyone in the world had some idea around Venmo, but I just naturally had an idea around how commerce needs to be digitalized. And over the past decade plus, that obviously has happened in spades all across many different forms. But that's always been like a driver for me. And in particular, I think financial services or financial products are literally everywhere you look. And when you think about different end markets and verticals, we could talk a little bit about how in vertical software in particular, like all roads lead to financial services products, right? Mm-hmm. There's so many vertical software businesses out there that have embedded finance as part of their offering at some part of their journey. And I think it's true that ultimately, financial products are everywhere you look, and technology is a great way to bring forth financial products in a more cost-effective, efficient way. And that changes how transactions and commerce work all over the world.
I did a great podcast a couple of years ago with Matt Harris from Bain, and it was every company is a fintech company.
Yeah, a little bit like that. They're two big things. Every company is a fintech company and software is eating the world. And I believe in those two axioms.
And I'd add that every company is an AI company too, right? Because yesterday's innovation always becomes tomorrow's commodity. And if you look at it in the technological shift from on-prem to SaaS, and then within SaaS, there was a bunch of things that happened within the cloud, right? Like mobile and social and fintech. And now I think by the end of next year, if your product is not an AI product, I think you're a laggard. I think we're heading into the world where AI is doing the work autonomously, and there's enough data points to prove to that. For example, agentic wrappers on LLMs are 1.5-2 times more accurate and faster than the LLMs alone. And if companies are not leveraging these technologies to make the outcome better, faster, cheaper for their customers, I think they get left behind. And we're also, I think, interestingly, I feel we're heading in a world where if AI is doing the work autonomously, then why do you need a UI to do inputs? Like, what does the UI look like? It's a very interesting time. Wow. And fintech is a core part of it because, like you said, payments, and the more data you collect from somebody and the more data across their system you collect, like from maybe it could be product data stitched with financial data, you have the opportunity to offer products, financial products, lending being a big part of it. At Boast, we started with R&D tax credits and we collected so much data from a company's technical and financial systems that we then did a $100 million warehouse facility to lending. We securitized R&D tax credits to lend, right? So there's a lot of these interesting opportunities for businesses. Now, you've invested outside of fintech too, right? You've done Figma and Canva. How did that come about?
So ultimately, those two axioms we talked about, ultimately, I'm a big proponent of how software transforms workflows and drives impact in the communities in which they serve. And so while Canva and Figma not necessarily are providing financial products, the idea around any fintech that I've ever made and a lot of the fintechs out there that I'm really excited by, it's really how software technology and now AI is enabling them to deliver financial services products in a really cost-effective, efficient, and disruptive way. And so I would say Canva and Figma are not necessarily the ones that are doing the financial products themselves, but we can talk at length about any of the other businesses that we work with. And it's software-led. I think you did an interview with some of the folks at Ramp before, but
yeah,
it's an amazing, call it fintech company, but really what makes it special are the products that they've built. And those are software products. And embedded in it is obviously a financial services offering. But when you talk to customers and what got me so excited about Eric and Kareem and their leadership and what they built there, it's really about the products that they built and the love from customers that they had around the products that they built.
I think that's the ultimate thing, right? You build something that is loved and used by customers high frequency, high intensity, not like I got to use it once in a while, where you make it, you give somebody a product where it becomes a core mission critical thing in my journey that even removing it is a huge pain. I can't imagine living without it. ChatGPT is one product like that for me. WhatsApp is another product like that for me, right? I've stopped using Google. I exclusively use ChatGPT. And so if you can build a product, like building a product like that in a boring industry like finance is super, super hard. I think what Ramp has done is super commendable. Now, you've also invested across regions, right? You've invested not only in the US, India, London, beyond. What is the core principle you apply when evaluating opportunities, regardless of the stage?
Absolutely. We, and myself personally, are very thesis-driven. There are core themes in different markets and different, I would call them vectors of markets and trends that we're excited by and that we want to bet on. And whether that takes you across the pond into Europe or down south to Latin America or out east into Asia, we won't. The benefit of Iconic is that we're large enough and we have the scope that I don't think we would let borders really change or restrict us on finding the best businesses, the best founders, and investing behind the core trends that we have deep conviction on. I would say the most important thing for us is to have alignment with the founders that we work with. And when you find folks out there that are building in a way that really aligns with the philosophy in which you see the opportunity, you'll make that investment, you'll forge that partnership. And we've been lucky that we've been able to do, not just in the States, but all over the world at this point. And it's been working out so far.
Fantastic. So when you look at that alignment, right, I guess at Series A and Series B, give us some quantifiable rubric of how you assess. What does founder alignment look like? What does business alignment look like? What does the metrics that need to be aligned with your thesis to do a Series A and a Series B deal?
Sure, sure. Typically, we'd love to see businesses that have either visibility to call it like at least $1 million of ARR. And this, and that's a really soft target because we're really looking for product market fit. So I'm throwing that number out there because it's 80-20 type of rule where, and we've done deals way less than that and pre-revenue deals actually, but it's a really good proxy in terms of what kind of establishment you have in the market in terms of stability and hardening of your product. Series A's and Series B's, it's really interesting because we'll often come across bootstrap businesses that are 50, 100 million ARR that built their businesses without really taking any funding. And so that first round of funding that they take, it's a Series A, and I don't think that's necessarily indicative of the stage of business that they're in. But I would say from a stage perspective, as long as you've demonstrated product market fit, what we are really looking for, is there a unity between our thoughts on a particular market, the vision of the founders, and also what we're hearing from customers, you know? And sometimes it's about really how all the pieces of the puzzle fit together. We have met businesses where the growth is amazing. The numbers are amazing. The founder will say, hey, we're winning because of A, B, and C. But then you talk to customers and they're like, I love this product because of X, Y, and Z, right? And so there is a misalignment. You think you're winning because of these categories or these reasons, but you're actually winning because of these other reasons. And you got to parse that apart. Is it because, you know, the customers don't really see what the vision behind the vision is? Or is there something misaligned in terms of how you're going to market or how the product is really speaking to its own value? And then obviously between those two perspectives, does that align with what we think as well is the way and the path to victory? And we're not always right. But I think what forges great partnerships is that when we see and are aligned in how we think the path to victory is. Because when you aren't aligned, you can oftentimes like basically provide guidance, advice, or just see things differently. And I think healthy disagreement is always important, but I think fundamentally great partnerships start with really good alignment on what the goal is, what the opportunity is, and generically how we're going to row together to get there.
You know, the word product market fit is a really hard one, right? We say it a lot in Silicon Valley, and it's now proliferated across the world. What does that mean to you? Because it means something different to different companies, but there are maybe some fundamentals.
Yeah. So for us, I think there's it's a law of art versus science, but if you talk to enough customers, enough buyers, and you say, hey, this product as it stands today, is this something you want to buy? Is it strategic to you? Is it important? Is it a point solution or is it a platform? What's the roadmap? And are you excited by that roadmap? Are you too excited by the roadmap? As in what they are today isn't exactly what you need, but you're excited for what they're building in the future. And that's what you really need. I would call it not product market fit. That's like too early, but you really want to hear from the customers, like the idea of something is, hey, if they could build, this would be like at the top of my budget. This would be the biggest thing that I would fight for money for. I would go to my CFO and ask for a day in and day out kind of thing. And you find consistency in that. Sometimes that's 20 Fortune 500 CIOs or CFOs talking about it. Or if it's SMB software, you just hear it all over the place. Like how you build conviction in PMF, I would say, can vary in different markets for sure. And that's why I think there are some areas where we've made earlier investments and there are other areas that we've made later investments as well.
Could you share maybe one or two examples of companies, maybe one earlier and one later that you've really loved or like you got drawn to the product market fit and what that was?
Sure. Yeah, I would say there are two I could talk a little about. They're both pretty early bets, I would say. Last year, we made an investment in a business called Pepper. They really provide commerce tools for food distribution, actually. And when you talk to food distributors, like traditionally, it's amazing. We're in 2025 or 2024 at the time. And the way grocers and restaurants order their food, they're still like going through catalogs, making phone calls and texting their sales reps. It's, hey, I need chicken. Hey, I need rice. I need et cetera, et cetera. And that's how the commerce there is still done today. And what Pepper is providing really is a digital portal for these counterparties to really interact and transact with one another. And so you got to ask yourself, hey, like in 2025, how is it still done this way? There are many different end markets and verticals where you'd be surprised how little technology has really penetrated it and has really transformed. And so you talk to the food distributors that we're in a world now where we're seeing a paradigm shift. Mobile's everywhere. I think the next generation of labor workers is a lot more tech forward than they used to be. And you can start to get the telemetry points from the market. Like this is something that is being a pull rather than a push. And you're starting to see that hockey stick moment. Now we'll see if we're right. We'll see if the business and investment plays out. It's going really so far, but those are the kind of data points that we're looking for. And the narrative and what we're hearing from the customers and obviously how the team at Pepper is really thinking about it, they really align well together. And that's what's exciting. We made a similar type of investment in a business called Primer, which provides infrastructure to manage your entire payment stack for merchants, big, medium, small. And there's a really compelling, I would say, idea and thesis there around how in the future, you have these amazing PSPs out there, but what merchants are going to really want is intelligent management and of the infrastructure for payments. Not every merchant can afford to staff up hundreds of engineers to manage multiple PSPs or create decision engines, manage fraud, manage identity, think through chargebacks and all this kind of stuff. And Primer provides software to be able to integrate, manage everything, analytics, and orchestrate all of it, basically. And that hasn't really been, I would say, mainstream today with merchants in today's world of commerce. If you talk to a lot of merchants and you walk them through this like utopia of the future, like they're excited by it, right? And so you can start to see that the product market fit, the story really resonates with big decision makers, right? Now you got to build a product that can actually accomplish all that. There are a lot of different dynamics that I say would enable true success at scale, but you hear enough from these merchants that are like, that is the future. That is what I want. And the first company that can deliver that to me on a silver platter, like I would be so excited to buy that, right? Those are great data points. Those are great telemetry points. And our job is to get a really good pulse on the market, hear from these folks, these decision makers, and hopefully we do right and we make the right call and make the right investments.
Fantastic. Now you built this reputation for deep long-term partnerships with founders. What are the key elements that contribute to a successful relationship between investors and founders?
So we talked a lot about alignment. I really believe in that. And I think with alignment, the most important thing is trust and mutual respect. I think firms are important, brands are important, but you know what I do appreciate with a lot of different founders is that they really understand that ultimately we're in a people-driven business and relationships really matter. And so I think a really healthy partnership starts with the acknowledgement that we are on the same team and we are there to help you accomplish everything, like when we win together. And not every partnership in our industry always works out. And there's always like some drama here and there. And I think that always stems fundamentally from misalignment. And that's why I think that matters so much. But I think with trust, communication, mutual respect, and alignment, those are the core pillars for any incredibly successful partnership.
Trust is the cornerstone of all relationships, and great companies, great relationships, great partnerships are built in an alignment of core values. Do you have a couple of non-negotiables that you try to align on with founders or in general with any relationship?
I think different firms have different principles, and different people, individual people, have different principles for sure. And so in this industry, you've seen all sorts of different structures and colors. For us, I really value simplicity. And so when we work with founders, like the non-negotiables, in my opinion, are really when it comes to the nature of your partnerships. We try to keep things as simple, clean, like standard terms, no structure, things like that. I think with complexity breeds misalignment in incentives. Obviously, when you're actually building a partnership with the founder, you need to spend time. You need to really get to know the person. And when you have that, that serves as a foundation for, from a commercial angle, hey, are we rowing in the right direction in terms of building a great business? And then obviously from there, making sure that everything about the partnership is as straightforward as possible so that there's really nothing to be thinking about other than how do we win together?
Makes sense. I like that. Oftentimes, every actually relationship, friendship in my life, when I reflect back that has gone bad, it's like a fundamental misalignment of core values. And there's often this one thing where the core non-negotiable value is in violent opposition with the others. Like, and you could never see it because when you're starting out or when you're poor, you ignore those things. And then money doesn't change you. It just brings out your true values, right? And then you start to see friction. Even in the companies I advise, it's just commonplace. So I like that focus on alignment. Has there been like a crazy chaotic company situation where this co-founder or the relationship with the founders and collaboration with them were pivotal to saving the day? Can you maybe give us some interesting?
I would say during the Silicon Valley Bank saga, that was a really crazy time. I think everyone was stressed. There was like real existential risk for businesses, our own business, other businesses in our portfolio. And how do you think about partnering in like one of the darkest periods of time? I would say the onset of COVID was another one of those moments, right? But I just remember SVB very vividly because when that was really going down, I work with a double-digit number of businesses and I'm spending 10, 15, 30 minutes an hour each. And so quickly, I'm like working through my list, making sure I call everybody and I'm like in the weeds, working with them, coming up with a game plan, coming up with contingency plans around how to manage this situation, reporting what we're hearing from other places and just working deeply as partners with them. And in that crisis moment, it was interesting because before you knew it, like it was the evening and I had started the day at 7 a.m. making phone calls and I was like in my room doing all these calls and I couldn't believe how quickly the time passed by basically. That was a wild time. And I think that to be able to work in deep partnership and in an intimate way with all your businesses, like that comes from trust, from vulnerability. Everything's on fire at the moment. No one knows what's going on. And to be able to make quick decisions, I think you can only enable that if you really have deep trust in your partners.
Fantastic. Now we're heading in an interesting world, right? Every company is becoming a fintech company was the theme for a bit. And now every company is forced to become an AI company. You either stick to the past and die or embrace the future and thrive. What's happening? I guess I see this
sort of VC 3.0 in a broad sense. If you say the first technological was on-prem silicon, and then it was the 2.0, which is cloud, mobile, SaaS, it's all in the cloud. And now it's all AI first. How is this impacting the way you invest and the way you look at startups?
I think that's a great question. I think there are some folks who are talking a little bit about how AI is going to crush everything, change everything. I think that's a little extreme for sure. Mm-hmm. I absolutely believe that AI is an essential to be a conduit to make yourself competitive and relevant in this new paradigm that we're living in going forward. I think Canva is a great example of this, actually. I think there was a lot of fear or considerations around how AI can transform or disrupt industries like which Canva plays, for example. But I think, and my personal thesis was, and what drives our continued partnership there is, ultimately, it's a little philosophical. I think creatives and humans want to maintain their agency when it comes to decision making. And so the love for something like a Canva really comes in the form of the workflows, the UI, how they work with the product, how the product helps them realize their creative vision. And yes, do they have amazing tools, content, templates, things like that? Absolutely. And historically, there was a whole marketplace of sorts to be able to help drive that. But Canva is one of the most forward-thinking businesses in AI, being able to leverage AI to improve their cost structure, expand their capabilities, and deliver them in faster, more efficient ways. And ultimately, the agency of the creative is maintained, their love and their interaction with the product is maintained. In fact, it's enhanced, but they're getting even more out of it because of AI. And I think credit to Mel and Cliff for leaning in hard and building upon that to be able to be the conduit that brings AI to the masses. But without that philosophy, you could put yourself at risk of actually getting disrupted. But what I personally believe and what we're really seeing is that the big brands and the big winners of AI are going to be the ones who already have that distribution, have that customer advocacy, and aren't sitting back, but are really leaning in and bringing AI and leveraging it to deliver more to those customers and to their communities. And I think if you have as a great example of that.
I 100% agree. A lot of people, and I've been in the space of automation, dating back to rules engine, to AI, to models and so on, right? A lot of people think they'll just ship a single agent application and it's going to disrupt industries. You have the opportunity to disrupt industries that are largely service oriented. But if you're competing with people like Canva who are sitting on so much data, right? In the AI space, these agents will get commoditized very quickly. Your real moat is the data network effect that gets you to a concept drift resilience, which is you can adapt in real time, built on voluminous data where workflows perform at high intensity, high velocity, high frequency, right? Canva has that. They have the data. A new startup for it to come and say, I'm the AI version of Canva. And to make that fully autonomous, they're going to have to get the volume of data that Canva has and train it. And that's a hard thing to build. I think you're bang on. Companies that have already established brand and customer moats have volumes of data, and they have the opportunity to build these AI agents on top of that data that become the standard. And so it's not, you'll build something like in the SaaS world, right? You could build an application that's better than an on-prem clunky application that went from just put a veneer and didn't really have the product DNA and went from on-prem to SaaS. You could crush them by some growth tactics. I think Absolutely. In the AI world, it's going to be a lot harder because how are you going to get proprietary, high-quality data?
Yeah. The other thing, which is a derivative of sorts, is that I do believe that with AI, you've lowered the barriers to entry in a way for new products to emerge, right? The technical talent, a lot of these coding agents or co-pilots, it allows people who are maybe less technically inclined, but really experts in their end markets to be able to access and build products in ways that historically was less accessible before. And so I think you will see more point solution or emerging competition for any business, frankly. And what I believe it really highlights is that the winning businesses and the winning founders are those that really understand their customer. There are some industries out there where it could be like the coolest, most technically savvy, amazing product ever, but it's like this old analogy of selling a Cadillac or a Porsche to someone who just wants to drive a sedan or something like that, right? It's not necessarily going to really land with the customer. And sometimes I think what actually really wins is when you just understand your customer incredibly well and you build a product for that persona. And you don't have to be like some rocket scientist engineer to be able to build that. You just need to know your customer and your end market really well. And what it also enables and will show is that true platforms have the unfair right to win, exist, and consolidate share. Point solutions can emerge. They can be ankle biters, but they're not going to be able to have their day, especially when there's going to be more of a crowding of point solutions that come up and they start to beat each other up. And so strong brands, strong advocacy from customers, and established platforms and strategic categories, I think are going to be the ones that accrue more value. And hopefully the investments and the identification and processes that we've been a part of, you know, folks like Canva, folks like Ramp, folks like Flowcast, I think are going to be the winners of the day that we're really excited about.
Fantastic. How is this changing VC outreach? I'm really curious, how do you get in front of such awesome deals? And does any of this change the way you outreach and get in front of prospects who are fundraising?
So in terms of how we outreach, not necessarily. I would say that this is still a human-driven industry. At the end of the day, we're very focused on building relationships, spending time, whether it's on Zoom or in person, with these founders, being partners to them even in advance of actually making an investment. And we have a large community and a ton of resources that we try to bring forth and actually be helpful to businesses in really unique ways, even before we actually make an investment. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily changed how we go about that part. I will say that there is obviously tooling and things like that that will enable us to be more effective at our jobs, and it's transforming the way work generally is done. But ultimately, how we find these, it's a combination of a few things. There's, I would say, thesis-driven investing. There's just like the network and the world that we live in, and we just hear like the buzz. There's references. There's a network of people who've also invested either early or later stage in different businesses. We are talking regularly with buyers in over the world, whether it's at the enterprise level or at the small business level, around where their pain points are, what they're thinking about, the trends and the macro dynamics that they're dealing with. And that helps guide us in thinking about, if this is a recurring problem for restaurants, we should think about different technology solutions that might be out there that is trying to solve this problem or something like that. And so it's an art at the end of the day. We have a great team at Iconic that is leveraging every single tool and every single vector that we can think of that I've just talked about to try and find really great businesses out there. But nothing gets done without having a conversation and being able to meet these founders where they are.
100%, man. Anytime you incorporate more than two senses, you start to build stronger connections. We're like sound and sight. If we hung out, we'll probably spend more time. It would be taste, touch, smell. And then that starts the relationship for more and more meetings. I tell you, you guys do a lot of events as well.
I don't know what a lot counts as, but we definitely do events for sure. We have a great team here that's putting stuff together. We also do really cool, I would say, like CEO gatherings within our portfolio, also outside of our portfolio. We have a technical advisory board with some really rock star engineers and technical leaders. And there are different topics and themes that we host fireside chats on, dinners, things like that. But there's a whole robust calendar. And none of it can be done without the amazing people that we have on this team here at Iconic to make it happen. But it's a way for us to bring more to life the community that we've cultivated.
Definitely. And a lot of people that you guys can bring as Iconic are typically inaccessible. So you have that opportunity, not only cultivate the relationship with the founder, but actually be helpful for the founder, right? If the founder can walk away with you or at your events with one connection that changes something mediocre in their business and makes it iconic, I think you've made a friend for life kind of thing, right? Even if they may not do a deal with you, they'll pass you other deals when they come across.
Absolutely. We very much believe, again, it's a human-driven business and world that we live in. And all you really have is your reputation and your credibility. And we're very results-oriented. In the way that we want our businesses and our founders to be impact-driven, we want to be impact-driven ourselves. And so we literally track, like, how many introductions are we making? What are the outputs and outcomes of those introductions? What are the commercial impacts of those introductions? Who are the hires that we've been able to help reference? Like, we are very relentless in analyzing and tracking what we're doing for our portfolio companies so that we can hold ourselves accountable for actually living up to what we're selling, which is partnership at the end of the day.
Awesome. As you look through 2025 and beyond with this massive technological shift, AI, agentic AI, what are the biggest opportunities in fintech and what specific trends will define the next generation of fintech?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of really interesting theories and we're keeping a weather eye on it. And it depends, because fintech can be a very broad definition, right? But I look at no further than Ramp as a great example where AI is driving so much of the value that they have in terms of being able to basically automate a lot of like expense management, spending, things like that. Slowcast is doing the same thing where effectively they are adding AI to transform the way accounts work. How do you close your books? How do you track expenses? How do you categorize these expenses? How do I find the receipt and match it to a business purpose? Things like that. There's so much that AI can do and be layered into the product to drive efficiency, impact. And I think these businesses are really leaning in hard to really like basically completely transform the way their customers actually engage and go through their day-to-day. There's also a broader, I would say, call it commerce side of fintech. And we could talk about anti-fraud. We could talk about chargeback management. We could talk about low cost route optimization, optimizing auth rates for payments. There's so many different things that I would say AI is adding further intelligence to and being able to increase the output, economics, and efficiencies of how commerce is really done, whether that's cross-border, domestic, whether it's online, in-store, with its retail, food, it doesn't matter. Like the way commerce is being transformed, the way payments are being transformed, there's a whole new category around like returns and returns management and logistics and shipping and how AI is optimizing like routing and decision-making and cost management and all those different categories. There is so much going on. And I think AI has really just supercharged all of these trends in these different categories and different markets. We could talk about wealth and banking and, you know, how the angle of customer service or customer engagement with AI bots, with AI agents, you can actually deal with a lot more customers from a customer service perspective. Like it's transforming the banking industry. When you think about how AI and technology is actually changing the way wealth managers actually work with their clients and engage and make decisions, there's a lot that's going on there to actually transform and change the economic model, honestly, in the way these old industries have always worked. So it's pretty cool to see, and we're keeping track of all of this and really trying to make sure that we're staying in front of it all and forging partnerships and investments that are really backing the way we're seeing the world.
I think AI creates a lot of abundance. Everyone's afraid that AI is going to take their job, but what AI is going to be really good at is level you up at work, give you more agency, create more abundance. I think it's a bigger market in the sense that when you're selling to role replacement versus tools, it's like trillions versus hundreds of billions game. But also you're giving people a lot of agency so they can level up and do more with less. So I love that you're saying that. I think banks, man, I hate banks. I'll tell you. It's not. I spent, when I had nothing, I would line up. And when Boast was a small startup, I would line up at Bank of America to send wires. Okay. And even adding anything or removing anything is like, you're on hold or you got to take an appointment. And then I think my life changed. I think my investors at Boast, one of the best things they did to me was they connected me with Morgan Stanley.
Yeah.
And the technology doesn't matter in the sense customers care about outcomes more than products. When I can email somebody or text somebody and get a response in minutes, that is the best experience ever. I have peace of mind, right? Especially when it comes to money and people are proactive and responsive, you gain a great sense of comfort. And then you're like,
trust.
Trust. Exactly. And trust is a cornerstone of all relationships. I've had experiences with Bank of America or even Wells Fargo. We have lots and lots of money in there, company money, and you email them and it goes in a black hole for days. And then you have no other option but to make an appointment and show up there. And you email someone like Morgan Stanley and it's done. A wire even, don't even go in the app and load a wire. We'll send it for you. Just send us the details. And what I think now is with AI agents, every bank has the opportunity to replace that best-in-class customer experience that a Morgan Stanley can do for probably 5% of America and bring it to everyone else. Because there's no reason to not respond, right? And you can load the best templates and do this work and just deliver customers the outcome. So I think there's huge opportunity. A lot of the times people said banking needs to be disrupted. Banking is just a database for money. Can it store your money? And more importantly, can it grow your money? If you know the best-in-class behaviors that lead to the best-in-class outcomes, I think now AI agents have the opportunity to democratize that to the Luddite banks.
I totally agree. I think you're really getting onto something which is fundamentally what drives my thinking when it comes to fintech. Financial products, there's been some innovation, but financial products in and of itself aren't really innovating. Like storage of money is still storage of money. Deposits are deposits. Credit is credit. Have there been like fancy like instruments, CDSs, swaps, all that? Yeah, there's been some innovation in like the world of like financial products. But for the bulk of our economy, like payments are still payments. Deposits are still deposits. And so what really is the innovation when it comes to like neobanks or these new PSPs? And again, to our earlier point, it's how in the old days, it was how software is changing how these products are delivered, how they're manufactured, and the cost of delivery, and the impact, and the user experience. And now it's how AI is transforming all that as well. And so at the end of the day, you care about storing your money somewhere, making sure it's safe, and that's generating you a return. And there's like apps and now website portals, and you maybe have an advisor, you can talk on the phone, you can text, and like you're doing all that, but you're still investing in stocks or bonds or whatever at the end of the day. Now, if you have AI to just even improve the way you interact, that the way you monitor, or how you're recommending investment decisions, for example, things like that. There was a whole world of the bot trading category that was like the first generation of what we're moving towards in terms of more AI and more intelligence around asset allocation and around how to even interact with your wealth. These are all transformational aspects. And the same theme is at the end of the day, it's still just investing in the stock market, but the way you get from point A to point B is being completely changed through both software and AI. And I think that is like a core theme. And I totally agree with you in terms of how we're seeing the world.
I think everyone I've seen, right, they talk about technology as a way to sell something. Unfortunately, customers want outcomes and not many people realize that. And they currently receive that outcome through a certain experience. Let's call it a combination of workflows. You just have to realize that if I want this customer to get X outcome in record time, what would I have to do? And just imagine like I'm going to throw people, products, process, everything at it. And when you have this super awesome customer experience, which is I email my bank to send a wire. Within 30 minutes, the wire is loaded. I get a push notification. I review, I hit send. That is the experience, let's say, right? Or I want to know my portfolio performance and I can't figure it out with the app. The ideal thing is the app explains it. But I literally email somebody and they send me a report and they explain what's happening. Basically, how much runway do you have? How much do-nothing runway you have? How are you doing well year-to-date and how they're going to balance or even if it's needed?
If people can get back to you, if let's just imagine you throw people, process, technology, all of that, and they get back to you in record time, then now you can deploy an agent to do that, right? And leave it for last mile review. It's just a lot of banks and like governments, they have been built on this culture of move slow, file patents, and then do nothing, right? Pontification, because you in larger companies, you're paid on and the number of right decisions you make, and failure is a PowerPoint presentation on why it wasn't my fault. And in startups, you're paid on the number of decisions you make, and failure is like a rite of passage. And I think there's this opportunity for both to meet as AI agents take over. So I'm super, super bullish. In terms of embedded finance, it was a big trend. Does it still have legs, or is there something new on the horizon?
I still believe in embedded finance. I think the trend that you might be referring to, there were a bunch of businesses that were built on a mission of scaled embedded finance, but in a box, and you can kind of power that. But I think the idea around putting it all into a single package and not providing choice to your customers, that isn't a thesis that I would say has really panned out in the masses. There's definitely pockets of success and value there. But the philosophy and the idea of embedded finance is absolutely still real. And I would say it will continue to be that way. It's existed for the past many decades, and it will continue to exist. Along that theme around how ultimately every company is a fintech company, what even at Iconic, we have so many vertical software businesses that have focused more on core system of record or core workflow orchestration for different end markets, whether it be in construction or investment in Procore or in field services management, like our investment in ServiceTitan. But once you've actually tapped the core workflow, then you can start layering in financial services offerings and financial services products. And that is what we're seeing across all sorts of different businesses, a lot of vertical, a lot of horizontal as well. And that's effectively embedding finance in core software products that we are actually offering, and put AI on top of it or layer it into your product. And so, yes, that was the long way of saying, I think embedded finance is absolutely critical today, because it is a fundamental, I think, way that financial products are being brought to customers. And whether or not the category of embedded finance in a box, I think, is real or not, I think that there was a lot of hype around it. I don't think it's played out in the way that a lot of folks thought it would play out, but I think it's playing out in a different way. And a lot of people are looking to best of breed solutions and building their different products and finding different ways to actually offer those financial services products, but it's still happening and there's a lot of demand for it.
Honey was one such product, right? Would you say Honey was embedded finance?
Yeah, I would say in a way. And again, these categories have different nomenclature and different definitions of their own as well.
In rapid fire, then, as we close out, one embedded finance product that you believed in that it didn't work out, and it doesn't matter whether you invested in it or not, and one that you really think is doing well.
It's a great question. I think the story is a little too early to play out, but I think some of these businesses that are offering like effectively payment processing, card issuing, and all these fintech capabilities in a box to vertical software businesses, for example, they haven't gotten the same traction, I would say, as they were hoping to get. There have been pockets of value here and there, a little bit of purchasing here and there, but at the end of the day, the market for them isn't maybe as big as they would have thought. And so there's a few of those that kind of, I thought, emerged in, call it that COVID timeframe, that saw some really good initial traction. And a combination of like financial regulation, but also just the macro environment that they're in, it hasn't played out in the same way that I think one would have expected. I also think that there are businesses out there that have actually seen like a lot of really great success, but we see the ebbs and flows of businesses at the end of the day. We were big investors in Marqeta, for example, once upon a time, or infrastructure provider. I think obviously it's seen better days more recently from a trading perspective, but we were big believers in the vision and the founding team and everything like that. And I think it really had a huge impact in the industry. As time goes on, like there's some cyclicality, there's changes in cycles of talent and innovation, but the idea is very much relevant. Galileo was a great business and actually got acquired actually by SoFi. But there's a lot of these, I would say, infrastructure businesses that are really powering like the fintechs of today that are incredibly successful, incredibly important for the market, that markets that we're seeing today. And we'll see how it all goes. But I believe it's really a good indicator that there is a sustaining and durable demand curve for these products.
Fantastic. One thing I'm really bullish on, and I'm not sure if it's played out, I'm really still a fan of embedded lending. And I don't know if it's been figured out yet, but I think there's something to be said. You're sitting on mounds of customer data, and can you effectively become a bank? Because it's so hard to get like loans from the bank for a business, right? Can you effectively become a bank where you lend companies money on optimal business interest rates? And it helps them grow the business and it spurs the economy. I really believe in that, but I don't know. I haven't seen it play out.
There's a big category. There's a bunch of businesses out there that have actually been able to, there's these themes like banking the unbanked or lending to the unlendable and things like that. And they've actually built really durable, I would say, real brands and real customer traction for sure. And there's like the whole build a better mousetrap like type of idea around like, I have a better underwriting engine. I can assess risk and reward better than like the old school models out there. And I think the hard part to see quick success there is that it takes multiple cycles to show if your underwriting model really works. There's going to be good times, there's going to be bad times. There's going to be low interest rate environments, high interest rate environments, recessions, and really like withstanding the test of time and proving it out over cycles. It just takes time to really build that. But there are businesses out there that have really good books, and they're going through it even as we speak today. We went through COVID, we went through the post-COVID, we're in a different era right now in 2025. And these cycles continue to prove, I think you build credibility there, and there will be. Like in the same way that I would say Nubank completely transformed the way banking has worked in Latin America, I would say lending and embedded credit is a real category. I very much believe in it. And it just takes a little time to prove out because there's the side of it, which is like the losses side of it, right? And as you continue to prove it out, I think that will build durable value.
Certainly. As we close out, if you had to bet on one innovation in fintech that you're really bullish about and you feel will define the next 5 years, what would it be?
We'll see if we get there, but I'm very much on this theme of identity and anti-fraud right now and how AI will transform just the way we think about it, the way we manage it. Fraud, security, and payments is a real problem still today. I think there's been a lot of really cool innovation for it, and I think AI will be a big driver and a big step function driver of how we might see a big paradigm shift in it. And hopefully there are some really great businesses and prospects that we can work with and build partnerships around this, but I believe that there's going to be something big that comes out of that.
Fantastic. As we close out, any parting words of wisdom, maybe some piece of advice that has served your career really well that you'd like to share?
I think for investors and aspiring investors in particular, and I would also say for founders too, the best advice I ever got is you're not going to be successful at anything unless you have a deep passion for it. And that can really manifest itself in the type of founder you are and the type of investor that you are. But knowing who you are, like, I think there are a lot of amazing role models out there. If you're a CEO, you can look at like the Frank Slootmans of the world. You can look at the Elon Musks of the world. You can look at the Satya Nadellas of the world. And I would say that they have some common traits for sure, but they also have very different styles from one another. And I don't think you cannot be true to yourself in terms of transforming yourself to be like one or the other. You need to figure out who you are innately and lean into those attributes to be able to be the best founder, best CEO that you can be. And I would say the same thing for being a partner and an investor. There are different styles and different ways of being effective. I work with people who are very different from me and are incredibly effective. And for me, the growth journey has been learning who I am, what works for me, what my personality and what I best bring to the table is, and being able to be my best version of myself when I work with founders.
Fantastic, man. I love it. A great way to close out. When passion meets profession, you become Michael Jackson.
Hey, there you go. Love it. Thank you so much, man. Wishing you great success, and let's connect when I'm in the Bay next. Have a good one.
I love it. Yeah, we'll look forward to it. Thank you again for the time today.
Take care.
See you, man.
This episode is brought to you by Boast.ai. Each year, the US and Canadian governments give out billions of dollars in R&D tax credits and innovation incentives to fund businesses like yours. But the application process is cumbersome, prone to frustrating audits, and receiving the money can take up to 16 months. Boast.ai gets you access to research and development tax credits and innovation funding opportunities without the headache and red tape. Join thousands of North American companies leveraging Boast.ai software to maximize cashback. Check out www.boast.ai.
I need some traction.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this week's episode of the Traction Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star review. And you can find more information and all the resources mentioned in today's episode at boast.ai. That's boast.ai/blog. On the tech stack, thinking it was brilliant. Now I know that it's no way for you to build a unicorn. You need distribution to get growth in the truest form, just like Stuart.